Yes, ma'am, thank you.
Elizabeth Lancaster, on behalf of Mr. Lally. We are here today, I would like to reserve 5 minutes, sir.
5 minutes, yes, ma'am.
We are here today asking the court to remand Mr. Lally's case for a new sentencing hearing. The assignment of error that has been granted by this court is in relation to what we would deem as Commonwealth's improper arguments in relation to sentencing.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. It seems to me, let's grant for the purposes of my question that the prosecutor was way out of line in some of the things that were said.
Yeah, let's do that.
No contemporaneous objection was made.
Absolutely not.
And, you know, had one been made, it seems to me the prosecutor could have been admonished by the court. The jury could have been instructed to disregard the inappropriate comments, you know, and your client now seeks to benefit from his failure to object to the trial level by having a new trial out of the whole thing. So it seems to me we don't have any sort of manifest or ends of justice exception here that would apply.
Well, I'll tell the court to point to the issue that had there even been a contemporaneous objection, had there even been a moment where counsel had stood up and said, whoa, you can't do this, and the judge said, nah, jury, don't listen, pretend that didn't happen, and move along, please. I think an argument still could have been made that the jury had been prejudiced at the moment, even if the circuit court judge had not declared a mistrial. And I'll suggest to the court, if you look at case law.
Well, I mean, the point of your question, though, supposes that an objection had been made, and if it had been made and the judge had responded in a way that we didn't feel was sufficient to deal with the error, then, of course, that's one thing. But here,
Sorry.
Nothing was done, and
Understood, Your Honor, and we are stuck with that. Unfortunately, we're stuck with that. I was not trial counsel, and this is the argument I'm stuck with making. I have to convince this panel that this is a situation for which the ends of justice must be met. And, you know, I think in honor of my esteemed adversary here, she makes some excellent points with respect to, in her reply brief, with respect to, you know, where is the manifest injustice? How do you show this manifest injustice? And I would just ask the court to take a look. In particular, we cited McLean v. Commonwealth. Now, unfortunately, in McLean v. Commonwealth in 1960, this was before we had bifurcated trials. So, you know, this is one big event. We don't have the separation. And, of course, we're talking about just in a sentencing phase of this case. But what McLean says is, you know, we hold prosecutors responsible, not just for prosecuting criminal cases, but to do so in a way that upholds our honors of fairness tradition. They can do nothing to prejudice a jury, to obscure the minds of a jury. That this is something that we hold prosecutors to this standard. Back in 1960, in this case, they did make a contemporaneous objection, and the Supreme Court ruled that the judge's admonishment to the jury wasn't enough to overcome this prejudice. I would suggest to the court that when we have 70 years of sentencing doctrine where we have, you know, getting rid of talking about parole, getting rid of when we set bifurcated trials, when we have this sentencing jurisprudence over a period of time, and the Commonwealth not once or twice but repeatedly makes this argument flying in the face of that, I would suggest to the court that the sentence the jury gave, the 4 years, is the manifest injustice, and this is why. Because this is specifically what the prosecutor did, and it just so happened to tie up in this case, said, look, this is his prior case he had. He had 4 convictions, 4 12-month sentences. He served 4 days. Look at this. Look at this. See where he did 4 days? And then he said to them, if you want to give Mr. Lally this sentence, you sentence him to 4 years. Tacitly explaining to them, if you want to impose a 4-day sentence, I'm asking, with, you know, 3.5 years of probation, I'm asking you to impose 4 years.
Does it make any difference that the trial judge told the jury in the instructions that what counsel says during closing argument is not evidence?
I would suggest that it's not, Your Honor. I will tell the court for 2 reasons. One, it's not really, unfortunately, a standard of review because this, again, being a case where we're talking about the ends of justice. The court has made very clear, let me get to my page. It's not curative, Smith v. Commonwealth, 2003, it's not curative that a judge properly instructs a jury that arguments are not evidence when there has been this type of argument that I would suggest is so manifest in persuading a jury. You can't you can't unring that bell.
But the troublesome thing here is that if we were to grant any relief, then you and we are depriving the trial court of having the trial court could have said, this is outrageous. I'm granting a mistrial.
Yep.
Didn't even have that opportunity.
Absolutely, sir. Now, they did have an opportunity on a motion to set aside the verdict, and I'll tell the court in reviewing those transcripts, it appears that Judge Fleming was really unwilling to even get into the merits of the argument. He really just said, hey, look, this is a procedural issue. I'm not taking it up. You missed your opportunity. And it's a shame because I would have liked to have heard Judge Fleming's opinion about that, and I think this provides the court an opportunity not only to provide instruction to our circuit court judges, but also to commonwealths. You know, the reality is, as defense counsel and being a practicing public defender for 12 and a half years, you know, it always kind of, you messed this part up, you didn't head this correctly, you know, you didn't paginate your appeal, you're done. And it always comes back to us. In this type of case, again, where the argument, I believe, is so egregious, where the argument flies in the face of everything we're told about what's proper for sentencing, where Commonwealth is literally telling a jury, if you want to give them 4 days, give them 4 years, let the judge handle that other part.
Well, here's the problem I have. You know, and I understand your argument completely, but anybody who's ever been a trial lawyer knows that there are tactical decisions you make. Just because you can object doesn't necessarily mean you should. It might,
yes, sir,
might not be in your client. You know, so something is said in opening statement or closing argument that's arguably objectionable. It may, you may make the decision that you don't want to call attention to it or whatever at that
Absolutely.
Point in time.
And
judges are typically either at the trial level or the appellate level are not going to second guess those decisions. If you're asleep sure. at the switch, it's not the judge's job to fix it for you.
Of course not. Of course not, Your Honor. And I will only say in response to that, you know, the reality is, especially for public defenders, newer public defenders, this is trial by fire. I learn new things every single time I go into court. I do. I learn new things every single time I go into court. And to have a person sitting in prison for 4 years when maybe, in fact, a jury intended him to get 4 days because they thought, as was instructed by the prosecutor, that the judge was going to suspend all that time, that's a manifest injustice. And is that something that trial counsel has to sleep with at night because they didn't stand up after being told by the prosecutor it's really rude to do what you're doing, to stand up and object when somebody's talking, and now I've got to live with that, this person being in jail for 4 years. And I appreciate the court not wanting to step in and step into the shoes of Judge Fleming or step into the shoes of defense counsel, quite frankly. I'm only here to say, you know what, I make a lot of mistakes.
We also learn from them too.
Yeah,
hopefully.
And in the heat of trial, these are the things that happen. Mr. Lally should not have to pay for that. I'll leave it at that for my esteemed counsel.
All right, thank you, Ms. Bowen.
May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, Commonwealth of Virginia. You know, in order to prevail on the ends of justice exception, the defendant has to show more than mere error, has to show error and that there was a grave injustice. And when closing argument is improper, then the time to object is when those statements are made. And there was no objection, no request for a curative instruction, and most importantly, no request for a mistrial. If this was so egregious that it should be enough to ask this court to impose the ends of justice exception, it certainly could have asked for a mistrial, a timely mistrial request, which did not happen. This is not the limited circumstances which the ends of justice should be applied. And those types of circumstances have been held to be when an element did not occur, when there was a void sentence, meaning it was an illegal sentence, or when a conviction for a non-offense. And this is not the type of issue that is similar to those that have been found where the ends of justice, there's those limited circumstances. Certainly, the trial court gave some instructions that I think were helpful in this case. He said, at one point, you have to confine yourself to the instructions and don't worry about what happens afterwards. And also, there was, I believe, an instruction, although it's not in the appendix, the trial court made reference to that in at the beginning of all the evidence that argument is not evidence and not to be considered as such. And fundamentally, this is not parole. This is different than parole. The cases that are cited on brief, the issues with those cases is that there's another branch of government that it leads the jury to speculate that another branch of government might do something to alleviate the sentence. And this is different than that. This is, in fact, the judiciary that is talking about. And I think it's important that counsel has cited no case on this exact issue, no recent case on this exact issue, but asks the court to extend the rulings involving parole cases to this type of scenario. I'm not arguing that this was maybe not relevant argument, that went outside the bounds of what should have been relevant to what the issues were, but it was certainly not so improper as that it couldn't have been cured with a curative instruction. In fact, even when improper arguments about parole, which we do have precedent on, have been made, those types of arguments have been cured with curative instructions. So certainly here, by implication, where the argument is not of the same stature, and there was no request for a curative instruction. Certainly, if counsel had objected at the outset, probably could have cut off some of these statements. But even with a curative instruction, the jury would have known not to listen to these sorts of arguments. And finally, I would note that this may have been a tactical decision. You know, when counsel does not object to something and then later on says, look, this was so bad, something needs to be done about this, there's a question about whether counsel has just decided maybe it wasn't as bad then, but now I have an appealable issue. And we don't know that. The trial court certainly said that this might have been a tactical decision and therefore refused to entertain that argument. This was the type of argument that was curable, and thus counsel had an obligation to raise an objection, a timely objection. And unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Hearing none, thank you. Ms. Lancaster?
Thanks, sir. Just briefly, and in response to Ms. Bourne, I'll say to the court two things. One, Attorney General raises an interesting issue where we say in these types of cases, we're invoking the ends of justice when we see, an element hasn't been met or a crime is void. But I would suggest to the court, if you look at the language, the actual language of Winslow, which is related to a mid-trial plea agreement, the words that they use in criminal cases, this usually requires convicted of conduct that did not occur or a missing element. That's not to say that these are the only category of cases for which courts can then invoke the ends of justice. Usually, sure, absolutely, I would suggest those are the types of cases where you'd expect the Court of Appeals to go, that's not right. However, I don't think the court's restricted to only invoke the ends of justice in those particular cases. With respect to the issue of parole and being another arm of the state that is going to then cut down, it wasn't just parole cases that notion came out of. It was also capital cases where prosecutors arguing, look, give them death. You're not the one signing the death warrant. You know, the judge is the one who's going to impose that death penalty. Again, to basically take it out of the jurors' hands that they're not the one who are imposing the actual real sentence, and that was an error. So I would suggest to the court that it's not just this other arm. It's, in fact, error to say, hey, look, you're not the one signing the ink on the end. The judge is going to do that, so don't. You just say what you think is the best range, or as the Commonwealth attorney asked, give the judge the most discretion you can to put him on probation, which Judge Fleming did not. I'd also directing the court, again, to Coward in respect to the parole cases. It's just error for the court by its instructions or for counsel in argument to tell a jury its sentence imposed or confirmed is going to be set aside or cut down. And that is what the prosecutor did over and over and over again. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to remand for a new sentence.
Well, thank you very much. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the Castillo case.